It's Thursday, April 25th, and in Port Coquitlam, civic staff are now asked to dial 911 when there is an emergency in a civic building, first asking for the ambulance and then the fire. This is the Cambie Report. I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Patrick Meehan.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
What a show we have for you today. We have, like, so many different topics. It's fascinating, but let's begin with another number. $5. That's the amount that I suggest that you give to our Patreon.
You can find our Patreon on patreon.com/CambieReport.
Patreon.com/CambieReport. Patreon.com/CambieReport.
That was a solid C+ on the transition on that one.
Yeah, with all the grace of a baby giraffe. Or perhaps a stoner who has had a little too much on 420. So let us go look at the aftermath of the 420 Cella protest.
I listened to
Protestibration.
The latest... Who? Oh, I listened to the latest episode of this little podcast called Spirits of the Law, and on that sister show of this, you, Matthew, had a change of a come-to-Jesus moment, let's say.
Yeah, well, Jesus, like, look at that beard, look at that hair. He's obviously a stoner, and I'm the only Christian in the room. I think it is a protest. Sarah Lehman, my boss slash podcasting partner at Spirits of the Law, a podcast you should all check out, convinced me that because the legalization was done so very crappily, that there is still many, many reasons to protest. And in fact, I'm all for it now. Fuck the man and party on, fellow stoners.
So to fill a bit more information on what's come out is, first of all, it's been determined that this is the first year that the 420 Festival ever had insurance, which is a little odd, but they, as a component of the contract with Cypress Hill, they were required to get insurance, so they now have insurance.
Oh, contract law, the greatest of all of the private laws.
But the big thing is that, you know, there's a number of things that council and park board have been trying to do. So Melissa DeGeneva has been talking about moving a motion that says essentially that events like that should recoup all their costs in terms of the billing that you give to the organization. And so that would mean that, you know, all of the costs of repair, of policing, et cetera, would be clawed back, which, you know, we've seen results in these events no longer happening. You know, the good examples are, you know, various Easter events, the St. Patrick's Day parade, even the Santa Claus parade, if I recall correctly, was canceled at least 1 year in recent memory due to not being able to afford the various permitting fees. And so that's one issue. And I think the question with that, to my mind, is that the cost of doing business as a society? Like, are we as a society interested in making sure that any kind of an event that is of a major cultural nature in our city has to pay its own way? Or are we going to support them to allow them to actually flourish and grow so that we can be a city with festivals and with events? Now, obviously, there's the difference between the Vancouver Folk Festival and 420. I mean, one pretends it's got a reason to smoke pot and the other just smokes pot. But they are, like, these are cultural events that people do hold dear in their lives.
And if I might remind Councillor Miserable the Wet Blanket, we, like, constantly at a provincial level ask for things like the World Cup, for example, mm-hmm. to come to Vancouver and at exorbitant costs and ridiculous things because of the knock-on positive economic effects that these have. I think that the general tenor of an event like 420 or the Folk Festival or the Santa Claus Parade or what have you generally puts people in a mood to spend money if we're going to look at it from a purely heartless capitalist perspective.
Well, I like to compare, like, I agree with your first point off the top, you know, there is still a lot to protest here.
Yeah. Mm.
At the same time, I kind of almost look at the 420 event held at Sunset Beach more akin to Vancouver Pride Parade, where there is still discrimination against the LGBTQ community, and their protest of
yes,
that is valid.
On, Ian.
I have been told.
Some people are just born stoners.
But at the same time, the Vancouver Pride Parade has become a corporate showy festival celebration.
The selling
but
booths.
It has the support of the city and goes forward in that way. The Dyke March ends up being the anti-capitalist protest version end mm-hmm. of it.
Oh, yeah. Well, and in fairness, the gays have always been pretty entrepreneurial in their attitudes, and that's why all our floats are run by banks.
And so I get kind of both sides. I'm like, What, 420 can kind of go and follow the rules and
does the fireworks festival pay for all the grass that gets torn up on the beaches and the beach garbage pickup? And I don't believe it does. And I don't think that, you know, Councillor Kirby Young...
Also, infinitely more dog stabbings.
All right. And I don't think that, you know, Councillor Kirby Young, who's been leading a lot of this charge, because she's been sort of fighting the 420 festivals for years while she was on Park Board as well, is I don't think that she would ever apply the same rubric to fireworks or Folk Fest or Pride as she would to 420. And that's the one for me that really sticks for me is we single it out because it's a thing we don't generally like, which actually feeds into the idea that it's a, you know, it's fighting for rights more than anything else. But Matthew, you raised a really good point there about policing. And, you know, whenever I swing by Rogers Arena and there's a Canucks home game, there's dozens of VPD officers, there's VPD cars, they're shutting down roads and they're restricting traffic lanes. And that's got to be a significant cost to the VPD. But I guarantee you the Vancouver Canucks aren't paying that cost. And so when we have, you know, tens of thousands of people going to an event in Vancouver, if we as a society deem that event as valid, then we just have the police pay the costs, you know, Remembrance Day. But if we don't view that as, if some people in power say don't view it as valid, they seem to say, well, it needs to recoup its cost because it's not, I guess, societally beneficial to have 420. Now, I say this as somebody who really doesn't smoke pot.
The comparison with Remembrance Day, I'm like, I feel like the costs of Remembrance Day have been paid in a currency other than the Canadian dollar.
Well, yeah, no, and I don't disagree with you there, but a lot of like 420 pot activists would say that there are thousands of people of color incarcerated on trumped up cart charges of marijuana possession or cannabis possession solely on the back of it was a racist excuse. And that is a giant injustice. And you could say that they've paid, that there is that cost to it as well.
One of the other issues I think with the 420 is I wonder if this isn't a case of the organizers shooting themselves in the foot a little bit.
Thanks for bringing that up. Yes.
Just the behavior. And I'm not saying you should judge the whole All Stoners by their representatives, but
Twitter
has not been great.
They stonewall. They refuse to admit to tell anybody what safety mechanisms they're taking. One of the organizers, I think it was Jody Emery? I think it was Jody Emery, went on Stephen Quinn's show and refused to say whether or not they had insurance when, in fact, they already had insurance. And it's this level of being unwilling to engage and attempt for things. Now, they have said, or it's been said, that they have attempted to get permits in the past and haven't been allowed it on the basis that, you know, parks don't allow smoking in them.
I don't think that was the case when a bunch of people were sold edibles without food safe licenses, and then a bunch of people got food poisoning from rancid butter. But
that's the other thing, too, is we always hear about how many people get hospitalized after 420, but I've never heard how many people got hospitalized after the fireworks, and I am fairly confident that those numbers are not similar and that the degree to which and the events that caused it are very different.
Dogs get stabbed at the fireworks, as you'll hear on Spirits of the Law.
Oh, God. But yeah, I think, Ian, you've got a really good point, is that they don't, the organizers certainly don't act in a manner that is fair and honest with the city.
Well, from white smoke to white caps, you got a phone call yesterday, Patrick.
I think we can move from pissing all the potheads and anti-potheads off to now pissing all the sports fans off.
Yeah, really, we're...
Well, I thought we were going to go from the green grass to the green pitch, but... Oh, how many different bad puns can we make? So, here we go. So the Whitecaps organization, I've been a Whitecaps season ticket holder since 2011 when they joined Major League Soccer, and I was generally a fan before that. And it's come to light that in the 08 women's under 20 team, there was a coach who was abusing his players. There are allegations of sexual harassment. There are allegations of abusive behavior. There are allegations of all sorts of wrongdoing. Now, at the time, one of the players reached out to Bobby Leonarduzzi, who was then club president, and said, you know, I want to talk to you, and talk to him about it in a private meeting. And then he went and, according to the player in question, he went and told the coach what she had said and what she had complained about the coach's behavior. And then that player was, you know, told they weren't starting the next game and so on. And players were consistently blackballed. There's one accusation of the coach inviting a player to a tryout game in another city and then having the player get there and saying, oh, the game got canceled. Unfortunately, I don't know how you didn't get told. I'm the only one here. Oh, and by the way, the team only booked a single hotel room. There's another story of the coach called a woman into his hotel room. This is the U-20 team, the under-20 mm-hmm. team. Called a woman into his hotel room and said, it looks like you're probably not starting the game tomorrow. What are you going to do about it? And things like that. And so this is horrific. And so I wrote to the Whitecaps and I said, you know, I'm really pissed off. I'm probably going to, you know, I'm looking at canceling my tickets. And I sent my email in. I got a response back from Rachel Lewis, who's the chief of operations, the day of the last game, which is also the day that the Southsiders group was going to stage a walkout of the game. And the email said, by the way, we've released a statement. And the statement said, well, in 08, we contracted an ombudsperson, and the ombudsperson investigated and gave no recommendations, and so we did all of our due diligence. It's been reported by a reporter at the CBC that, in fact, the ombudsperson did not give any recommendations because the contract that the ombudsperson was under did not call for recommendations, only a stating of the facts. And so the Whitecaps are just manipulating the words here. So I tweeted a lot pretty angrily about it, and News 1130 reached out to me, and I did an interview with them, and there's an article that's up where I talked about it there. And then yesterday, I got a phone call from Bobby Leonarduzzi himself.
And sadly, we don't all have call recorders on our phones running all the time, like some people who've already been mentioned. What did the president have to say?
Well, so Bobby Leonarduzzi is a legend. For those that don't know, Bobby Leonarduzzi led Team Canada to its only World Cup appearance in 1986. Bobby Leonarduzzi kept soccer alive after the fall of the North American Soccer League in Canada. He basically kept the women's team going by working with the Whitecaps organization to maintain a women's team when Canada soccer wasn't even helping the women's team. And, you know, Bobby Leonarduzzi is also reigned herd over a lot of controversies over the last few years, and the whole team has. And I think so. I you know, and he really good on him to call me, and I think he's been calling a number of people that have been complaining, and I think he really wants to figure out a way to make this right. But this team has got a lot of problems.
This is, of course, coming like forward out of a general milieu in Canadian youth sport where mm-hmm. there is a massive problem, as it turns out, of sexual misconduct.
Well, and so, you know, Mr. Leonarduzzi, or Bobby, I guess, or he said, you know, in this situation, you know, we saw what was going on, and they at the time they broke up amicably with the coach. I forgot to mention this part. They broke up amicably with the coach. They fired the coach, but they said it was an amicable, mutual separation, is what they said publicly. And the reason this all came to light is because it came out that the coach in question is now coaching youth women's team in South Fraser or South Delta. He's no longer, now that this has all come about, but basically the player found this out and decided to come public with it. And so this has all come to a head. And I sort of said to Mr. Leonarduzzi, I said, you know, your team has John Furlong on the executive, who we know taught at a residential school in the early 70s and was accused of being violent towards the students there. Now, he was acquitted.
In a complicated libel
yes.
case and
yes.
He wasn't. Was he specifically acquitted, or was it that the court found that there was no grounds to proceed on
reverse libel?
Yeah, yeah. It was.
And then this is the same team that had a one of its youth players accused of sexual assault. This is the same team that signed a player that had been accused of sexual assault a couple of years ago. This is the same team that just this week it came out that they had a player coaching in their academy up in the interior who was essentially thrown out of UK soccer for racist actions.
Someone got thrown out of UK soccer for racist actions? The UK soccer where
he
like
threw a banana at an African descendant player that had written on it, fuck you, and then he told him to fucking eat it.
I mean, that actually sounds pretty par for the course from UK soccer.
Yeah, and so all this, and so like that's what I sort of said to Mr. Leonarduzzi. I said, how many times, like your organization, not just his organization, Rachel Lewis's organization, Jeff Mallett's organization, Greg Kerfoot, the owner, and Jeff Mallett, the owner, and you know Steve Nash. This is an organization that has been like, how many people have to be accused within this organization before you really do something about it? And I know I've been talking about this with you guys for a couple of weeks, but now that it's come to a head, I really want to get this out there because, you know, we should all be angry that Vancouver's major sports team, one of Vancouver's major sports teams, has all of this baggage. And there's got to be a cleaning of house happening in that organization at some point.
What should listeners be doing?
Yeah, so just write into the Whitecaps and say, you know, however many times you've gone to games, and say you might not go to games again. Say that, you know, and it's not just bad enough. Like, you know, this is so bad at this point that it can't just be one person. Like, this organization has to come to, like, have a mea culpa and actually figure out a way to fix itself. And you can find their, you know, write to them, phone them, just reach out to them and tell them, or tweet about them with their handle, and let them know that you're angry about all this. This is really quite a long laundry list of accusations.
I personally will be continuing my lifelong boycott of the Whitecaps.
I'm not against going to see a soccer game.
I'm just not
I lived in the UK for 2 years and didn't end up seeing any Premier League because I think I went to figure out how once, and you have to like be a member of the secret club and know the handshake and also be drunk.
Well, and this
so
is
I didn't
first,
get to see one.
But this is the first season where they have a jersey that actually looks really sharp and I really wanted to wear it. And now I don't want to wear it. You know, like, yeah, it's, this is happening in Vancouver. This is our city.
And moving along, the Granville Slope might have a new edifice that will grace our skyline. In fact, possibly the tallest wood tower in the world.
Yeah, so one of the big things that's coming out in sustainable development and building and construction is this move to manufactured wood buildings. Not your, we put cut some trees and use traditional 2x4s, but really
manufactured wood buildings. So manufactured wood is cross-laminated timber where large blocks of timber are basically glued together using very, very strong epoxy to make a material that is pound for pound stronger than steel.
Like particle board, but actually not breakable.
So it's not IKEA.
Yeah.
Of buildings. This is a proposal to do a tower of 35 to 40 stories at the corner of Pine and 8th Ave, which is near Granville Broadway, which, you know, it's going to be part of the Broadway corridor. Are we still calling it Broadway corridor? Is that
no,
offensive?
That's discriminatory.
You are, of course, referencing Councillor Hardwick's belief that the word corridor is discriminatory and you should refer to neighborhoods instead.
Mm-hmm. So the Broadway neighborhood may have this tower. Now, one of the big impediments to doing this is the city of Vancouver currently only allows you to build, I think it's up to 12 stories out of wood.
So interestingly, the province has announced that they've moved to the 12-story limit.
Isn't Tollwood building at UBC 17 stories?
That was given an express exemption.
Okay.
One of the many reasons it was placed at UBC.
Yes, where there are no laws.
Much easier to exempt basic laws. The provincial government has announced that they're moving to 12 stories. I don't know if it's effective now or effective next month or what have you, but they've announced it. Vancouver has its own building code, and I don't believe the change has been made yet. Now, in our podcast interview that we did with Matt Horn, the climate change manager at the city, he said that they were looking to do that already. Presumably, that's going to come out in the next couple months. The Vancouver built form will do that. The reason 12 stories is because the United States building code has been moved to 12 stories, so it's a lot easier for BC to justifiably move to 12 stories without having to do like large amounts of its own research, because obviously the United States building code has, you know, reams of research behind their decision. And so Vancouver is likely to go to 12. Now that's where the question comes in, is Vancouver could go over 12 if they want. Vancouver can do sort of whatever it wants. It has its own building code. So whether or not Vancouver wants to go to 35
or 40.
Or 40 is, I think, a question.
Now, it should be noted that, like, our building code recently was, and when I say recently, I mean around 2011, 2012, updated to allow for timber frame construction up to 6 stories, which allow for 6-story timber frame condos.
Which is why you often see the sort of bottom story, second story in concrete with a bunch of stickwork wood on top.
Yeah, or the fact that all of Kingsway is being bulldozed.
Yes.
So this is a project that is being proposed by Busby Perkins Will, a local architecture firm. It would still have a concrete core, but the actual construction of it would theoretically have a much, much, much lower carbon impact than one building that would be of similar height that would use steel and concrete style construction.
There would be no natural gas line in this building for probably obvious reasons.
Well, no, but there's natural gas line that goes into wood frame buildings all the time.
And
as
I think
well.
Part of it is trying to be future-proofed in terms of getting off carbon. And Bruce Landrels, president of Delta Land Corporation, who's proposing this, talks about how efficient they want to make this building. And he describes it as people might be able to use a single candle to heat their apartment which, again, like the manufactured wood doesn't burn easily. But
in fact, when it chars. It tends to char and then not burn.
But the perception of a wood building, and then let's talk about how we're heating our homes with fire.
Oh, Notre Dame.
Well, but that's the thing is, you know, and you see this every single time. We've covered this already when we talked about it, is the fact of the matter is when you build a mass timber building, it is just as good an earthquake as a concrete building. If not better, depending on how it's built.
It's flexy.
Because it flexes. And it is just as good in terms of fire as a concrete building because of the way that it's treated and all of the things that it does in terms of safety. You can still have blazes in a concrete building because people put things in concrete buildings that can light on fire and can be quite flammable. And so the actual frame itself, and this is going
to
be...
That's why they spray all of them with asbestos for like 30 years.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is going to be a long-term, I think, education process as everyone that hears about it immediately says, ooh, what about the earthquake? Or, ooh, what about this, that, the other thing?
And but this is incredibly important because like as Canada becomes the refuge for like... billions of climate refugees from around the world, we are going to have to put people somewhere. And if we need to create a built form that is dependent on concrete, it's like totally fucked. We're totally fucked. And so we have a large boreal forest, which will be less boreal as things progress. And so that timber frame construction will not only be one, possibly, according to some architects' projections, carbon negative, which would be amazing, and two, like much, much cheaper than carbon than concrete steel construction.
And aside from the environmental causes,
in terms of the cheaper, I had long thought it was cheaper actually, but one of the things that happened
has the potential to be cheaper.
Yeah, so mass timber is still mass timber buildings, regardless of scale, are still generally seen to be as expensive or slightly more in some cases than the equivalent in concrete or steel. I had a number of when this was first announced, I had a number of developer contacts of mine reach out to me to let me know, and they broke down numbers, and each of them did it individually, and all the numbers sounded fair. Right now, at the end of the day, mass timber delivery is still very pricey, and we're probably 10 years away from economies of scale getting it to a point where it really comes down to a point where it's lower than concrete or steel.
Yeah, and that was my point, mm-hmm. is that like we are 10 years away from total climate disaster and also 10 years away from the economies of scale being able to ramp up mass timber construction,
We as a society can make it more expensive to do concrete or steel, right? Just as the carbon tax, you know, we can find ways to disincent people from building with concrete or steel.
Maybe not exempting 90% of the lime and concrete emissions from the carbon tax, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the building also fits well with John Horgan Provincially's plan to or desire to see our wood products be used here. So all around, it's a win. And hopefully this goes forward.
Well, all around it's a win. I didn't exactly, when I proposed that story, expect us to be talking about the oncoming apocalypse, but there it landed anyway. Out in Surrey...
they've had their own apocalypse.
Yeah.
Well, it's complicated. Surrey's had a number of 5-4 votes, and so it's very clear that the Surrey Council that got all elected on the same slate is not necessarily all on the same slate.
Awesome. It's another Burnaby.
And so this is happening now. Now, it's come to light that Doug McCallum is the only member of his party now at this point. But, I mean, he does still have supporters. Some councillors say they're operating on a vote-by-vote basis. It seems fairly complicated. At the end of the day, most cities, even including Vancouver up until fairly recently, you know, you'd get all together under a party banner and then you'd get elected and then you'd all be individual councillors. And the NPA is operating like that in Vancouver, just as they always have. So those councillors aren't always getting along.
Modus operandi of the NPA.
Yeah. And so I think to cut through some of the high-handed language that's come out of this is that it's most likely that there's just no formalized party structure occurring there and that they're not bothering to sort of like make sure that they're all in the same party, because at the end of the day, Doug McCallum is going to do what Doug McCallum did in the 90s, which is he and a couple of other people will name candidates for the next election, and that's that.
Well, we talked about mass timber, and now the Massey Tunnel, which will unfortunately be made out of concrete, probably. Basically, there isn't too much to report yet other than the bridge, which was canceled.
The 10-lane.
Yeah, the 10-lane bridge. Widest bridge in the world, it would have been.
Replacing the
other widest bridge, which is the Portman. So that record not being one we are contesting anymore, there apparently still is some demand for a replacement or improvement to the Massey Tunnel that will connect South Richmond to Delta. And the mayors of now not only Delta, but Vancouver and Richmond and I believe one
Vancouver.
Other. Yes, Vancouver. I was surprised as well. Have gotten on board with a demand to the province that there be an additional lane each way for traffic, an additional HOV lane, separated bike and pedestrian lanes, because nothing's more fun than walking under the Fraser, and other potentialities therein. So this is one of the transportation projects that is going on, or rather being proposed around the city. The province is not saying anything at the moment.
Well, they are studying the issue, aren't they? There is a provincial study on their way, if I recall correctly, when they canceled it. That still hasn't reported back, if I remember right.
I think they had
that's the same as not saying anything.
Yes.
I think there was an initial recommendation that showed, a 10-lane bridge was too much.
Too much, yeah.
We either need a smaller bridge or
a 10-lane bridge next to the airport.
A tunnel that marginally increases vehicle capacity. It's not necessarily the end of the world. I think we are seeing, and we're going to get to it coming up, after we talk about bridges and tunnels and roads, we're going to talk about transit. We are seeing a shift away from cars, but at the end of the day, there are going to be choke points that you are going to have to do some road upgrades for. I personally don't necessarily think you do, but just because I live in my little bubble up in the Olympic Village doesn't mean that I get a chance to veto other people's projects.
I think having driven through that tunnel both in good and bad times of traffic, not frequently, but I can appreciate it is not just a choke point, but it's one of the major bottlenecks of the region.
Absolutely.
And the age of that tunnel particularly, and I think the warnings that, this isn't a safe place to be in an earthquake matter.
Well, in terms of the seismic, it did get a fairly substantial seismic upgrade about 10 years ago that they said would last 30 to 40 years at that time. As well, there are further seismic upgrades that can be done. There are a number of other upgrades that can be done. There are warning lights at the entrances to warn vehicles to stop going in the event that an earthquake is detected by USGS early detection sensors, which is better than I can say for most other bridges, because our other bridges are not necessarily earthquake ready either. And
namely
so,
Patello, but at least that one's being replaced quickly.
Well, and it's coming down all on its own right now, so that's fine.
Is that the one that nearly killed Linda Heppner?
Yes, that is.
Okay.
That is definitely the one where a chunk of concrete fell off and hit her in the head. But the tunnel as it is fine. And actually, one of the things I thought about today, to play off what you were saying there, Ian, is if you throw another one in there to twin it, that other one can then be the one that you use as the primary when you replace the other one. And so we can just keep hop skipping over this thing.
Fantastic. So in addition to some underground lanes that are being asked for, there are some HOV lanes that Langley might be putting in on Highway 1.
Yes.
Great. Moving along.
I've got it. Premier Horgan announced today that they're going to spend $235 million on widening Highway 1 in Langley. Now, before people get really upset about the idea of wild-induced demand increases, there is some validity to this argument. In this case, what they're going to do is they're going to widen it to add HOV lanes. So unlike what was done in other parts of Vancouver where they sort of took lanes away for HOV purposes, what they're doing here is they're widening for HOV purposes between 216th and 264th Street out in Langley.
Oh, now, that is the hell. That is the hellscape.
Yeah, so what's happened over the last 40 or 50 years since the highway went in was essentially Langley regeared itself around the highway. Similar to how the North Shore has regeared itself around the upper levels highway, where most trips happen on the highway. In Langley, a whole metric ton of trips are people hop on the highway for two exits and then hop off to get to their destination. And that area does get really jammed up. So having an HOV lane through that area seems like a reasonable idea.
The only times I ever drive that section of highway is usually with my wife or with someone else, because we're going camping or we're going to the interior and we just want to get through it. No offense, Surrey, Langley, etc.
Well, and you don't have to go represent people at the Chilliwack or Abbotsford courthouses, so honestly, I am very pleased with...
So I'm usually driving the HOV lane as far as I can until it merges
and disappears randomly in Langley. Yeah.
And now if we can have a couple more kilometers of that, especially where there are some choke points of merging and whatnot...
It would just be nice
for everyone
if a jackknife semi-trailer wasn't able to block the entire road.
Yep.
Spent 4 hours on the highway moving 7 meters. Great.
Now, you can widen your roads as much as you want, but at the end of the day, there's only one thing that's going to get cars off the road and get congestion reduced, and that is...
A meteor.
I was going to say catastrophic climate change.
Yeah.
All of the above plus public transit. And so TransLink's Mayor Council had their monthly meeting today, and the primary element of the monthly meeting was a fight over SNC-Lavalin and a mayor trying to suggest that they could dig the tunnel to Arbutus but put LRT in it instead of SkyTrain because that would be better. Note, it won't. That's the
worst of all worlds.
Yeah, wait, what? That's so stupid.
I didn't catch which mayor it was in the live feed, but one of the male mayors.
Also,
of the
it's not if it's an LRT underground, it's a SkyTrain because that's what
staff noted if you weren't going to use the linear induction motor technology that is SkyTrain, what would end up having to happen is at BCC Clark, people would have to get off and get onto the LRT that's in the tunnel that would go across to UBC or to Arbutus. And the mayor said, yeah, that's fine. And I don't care if people have to make a swap. How much would it save in money? And the staff person said, well, we have no idea because he didn't say it was a stupid idea, but as I noted, is if you're going to have a one-off piece of technology, there's a whole host of ancillary costs that come with that you're going to have to deal with. And as I noted, one of those ancillary costs is you're going to have a maintenance yard, and because right now that extension, the maintenance yard is out at Edmonds, and that's fine. You're going to have to build a maintenance yard similar to the Canada Line has down south in Richmond. Where would that maintenance yard go? Somewhere between Arbutus and VCC Clark Station.
Let's bulldoze Kitsilano. It seems like that place is just full of...
I mean, the property values there are pretty low, so the TransLink could buy up some property for a maintenance yard pretty easy, right?
Yeah, sounds perfect.
Anyways.
The trains will just always work perfectly.
So this is that ongoing thing as people are trying to sort of take things away from Vancouver, I think. But TransLink did release their annual bus or transportation system performance review, formerly known as the bus performance review, annual bus performance review. What this is it's an annual report on how every single route in the region does and how the whole region-wide does, how different subsects of the region are doing. And if you may have heard, there was a 7% increase in transit usage last year over the year before, which adds up to a 3-year trend of 18.5% increase in transit usage, which is mind-boggling. The bus network was the one that bore the brunt of most of the increases at 8% increase year over year last year to the year before, which means that most buses on the system are now significantly overcrowded at rush hour. Because while significant amounts of extra bus service hours have been added, as TransLink's own staff said, that's not keeping up with the increased demand.
So buy some new buses. Also, if you are interested, a list of the worst bus routes in the Lower Mainland was released, including my personal bugbear, the 49.
The 49, which came in at second for the second busiest bus route in the region for annual boardings at 9 million annual boardings.
Mm-hmm. After, of course, the 99 B-line, which...
17 million. And continues to be the busiest bus corridor in North America.
Yeah.
The 9 was in the top 15, which means the 9 and the 99 are...
The 9's the overflow.
The 84 is
actually,
the overflow, too.
I once heard the 99 described as the free one, whereas the 9 was the...
you
have to pay for that one.
The 99 free line.
You're welcome.
The 25...
I'm actually not joking about that. I was the VP external that got TransLink to do all door boarding when I was at UBC.
Thank you.
The 25 was also fifth on the list, which goes to show how many different routes juggle around the 99 and probably take some weight off the 99. South of the Fraser, if people are interested, the busiest bus south of the Fraser continues to be the 319, which continues to significantly outperform the two other bus routes that are getting or have been upgraded to B-lines, which is the Fraser Highway bus as well as the 96 B-line that runs along King George Boulevard.
Incidentally, people should still pay for transit when they use it.
Yes.
One of the reasons that I think the 49 had such a poor performance was there has been a lot of construction along 49th that has reduced the available transit lanes to one. And so I'm interested in knowing whether or not there is like actually a ton of like
yep.
structural delays that are built into the route. However, the reason it is so popular, it is the best way to get from Metrotown to UBC on a single bus.
Well, and notably, TransLink did really highlight that in the last 5 years, they've had $64 million in lost service hours due to vehicles are now slower than they were before. Over the last 5 years, the average vehicle speed of a TransLink bus has been slowing, and part of that is because of increased congestion. So what that means is that your buses are taking longer to get to their destination, which means to move the same number of people, you have to move more buses, which means that it costs you more money. And so every year that increases. Last year to this year alone, or last year to 2018 alone, was something like a $14 million increased loss. That means that over time, we have to pay more for a less efficient system. If we can get more cars out of the way, or if we can add more dedicated bus lanes, like is being discussed at the City of Vancouver, and the City of Vancouver, in fact, will be introducing a bus lane for a part of the 41 route to improve it along its way to get to Joyce Station, that will drastically increase the efficiency of transit. And that's one of the things that I think we're going to be grappling with as a region going forward.
Well, so whether you are interested in things being discussed at the City of Vancouver or simply are have some level of disgust with the City of Vancouver, I am pretty sure everyone is going to be very interested in how TransLink is going to be proceeding forward. Well, in particular,
I was going to say, there was a couple other interesting bits of data out of there. You were telling me the new most congested SkyTrain station is yes. no longer commercial Broadway.
Well, so technically the busiest SkyTrain station on the system is Waterfront Station, because they combine the annual boardings of the Canada Line and the Expo Line.
Right.
But in terms of non-cheating ways of looking at it, for the longest amount of time, the number one busiest SkyTrain station outside of Waterfront in the region has always been Broadway Commercial Station, which makes sense. In the last year, there has been a 20% increase year over year in usage of Metrotown Station. Part of that's because the more buildings have gone in. Part of that's because Metrotown Mall is obviously a huge destination. And part of it's because it's no longer a giant construction zone. But what that's resulted in is Metrotown is now the second to Waterfront busiest station on the whole line.
I notice that coming in every day.
Absolutely. I believe you do. Because you're coming in from Royal Oak, right?
Yeah, I'm on the other side. So
you watch
as
the bus the SkyTrain half empties out and also fills up again.
And I'm on the quiet side.
There you go. But yeah, it's the bus performance system or the transit system review is something that I look at every year really religiously and is always filled with interesting tidbits. But that's not the only thing that they were debating yesterday at the mayor's or today at the mayor's council.
I wanted to make like a millennial line, millenarian line kind of joke, but it's
well. But also, I don't think we're talking about millennials. If we're talking about youth on transit, I don't think we're talking about millennials anymore, Matthew.
Zennials
might even be below that.
Isn't it it's still the Millennium Line, though, right?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
But if we're talking about free transit for youth, we're definitely not talking about the Millennium Line.
I was making a religion joke about millenarianism, like the...
Right over my head.
Seventh-day Adventist, whatever. All the grace of a baby giraffe. All right. So, there is some discounting going on.
Very probably. So almost for sure, they're going to change the way they fine youth and low-income people on the system when they ride without a fare or when they ride without correct fare. So almost for sure that's happening. And that's going to make it a lot easier so that, you know, when a 17-year-old gets 4 or 5 tickets, they don't bother paying them. Once they turn 20 and they get a car, they don't suddenly have to pay a bunch of money and they're broke when they're, you know, struggling to get by. Same thing with low-income individuals. And Kennedy Stewart put it much better than I could. But what they're really looking at is this all-on-board campaign, which is calling for low-income individuals as well as people 5 to 18 years old to be able to get free transit on the system. Now, they broke that down into how much it would cost. So they would have to increase fares by about 15 to 20 cents in order to give youth all youth free transit pass. So everybody else would have to pay to do that. But the one that I looked at was property taxes. How much the average property tax in the region would have to go up to give everybody from 5 to 18 years of age free transit access. $22 to $27 a year.
Well, as a property owner now.
Oh, I've been waiting for you to do this.
I will pay that.
it's stark, right? Like, and we know from the UPass experience and also from other regions is that when you give somebody a free pass, they'll use it, first of all, but that it creates a long time, lifelong transit user. If you understand the system, you're more likely to use it going forward. So one of the best investments we could have as a society, potentially, is giving people 5 to 18 years of age a free pass as well, obviously. And I think I shouldn't have to make the case, but low-income individuals getting mobility lift throughout the region is probably one of the most socially just things we could do.
Interestingly, and this is another shameless plug for Spirits of the Law, a podcast that you should check out, a podcast for those who are called to the bar, is that there were three policies that Sarah and myself and our guest Andrew Forshner were talking about in terms of what are the worst liquor policies in the region? And basically none of them were actually liquor policies. It was about SkyTrain lines and zoning and how food primaries work, which I guess is kind of a liquor policy. But like all of these things are very intersectional. But this is, of course, very much rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic when, of course, the icebergs have all melted. There is a climate motion coming, though.
So the climate motion was debated pretty heavily yesterday, and some minor amendments have been made. Essentially, Christine Boyle has brought forward...
Climate motion at Vancouver City Council?
Yes. So Christine Boyle's motion of January has resulted in a staff report now that's got 6 main planks to it, very significant changes to our city that I think we're going to really touch on in detail next week once they finally decided. Essentially, what happened was council heard a number of delegations speak on it, including former councillors Gordon Price and Peter Ladner, and a number of others, and they had some very minor amendments. Colleen Hardwick, Councillor Hardwick, believes that there needs to be robust consultation before we go forward with anything to do with climate change. Melissa DeGeneva, Councillor DeGeneva, really was adamant that they need to strip out a lot of the goal setting in this report because she believes that, you know, the previous government, the Vision Vancouver government, made promises they couldn't deliver, and therefore it's important to not make promises.
She's half right.
She said it marginally better than that, but it was a long one. And so that's sort of where that's going. And it seems like we're going really rapidly towards it. Councillor Swanson also attempted to amend the motion to include the all on board campaign for youth and low income transit, which fair. And also that the city of Vancouver should incorporate as parts of its goals that it includes greenhouse gas emissions that occur outside of the region. And she specifically cited the Site C Dam as the one that she wanted to include in the actual as an actual amendment.
Sorry, what?
Yet no one was really clear on what that was, and I believe it was voted down. But it was very confusing.
I get the
This kind of harkens back to my problem with Councillor Swanson on council. Is that like she has a point very often?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But she can't make it very coherently. Too much of the time.
Well, like, let's say, for example, that, you know, 10% of our energy source that creates our electricity in Vancouver comes from coal, and the coal plants are outside of Vancouver. Well, we might want to account for that in our accounting of our greenhouse gas emissions and say that, well, that is a thing. And that's, I think, what she was getting at. But it was definitely opening us up to a very large, large commitment.
It gets complicated very quick when you try to take on upstream
the entire,
and downstream.
Yeah, the entire upstream planet. Thing.
That doesn't mean it doesn't matter.
Well, as it turns out, we've dammed the entire upstream, so that might be...
so that was the climate change. We'll get into it a lot more next week, and I think we've got a guest or two lined up. There was one other thing, was that the Resiliency Department of the City of Vancouver, which is essentially a department that builds out emergency response planning as well as other things of that ilk. Obviously, it's been focusing heavily on emergency response for earthquake. Councillor Colleen Hardwick took particular umbrage with the idea that we're preparing for an earthquake. She was very, very adamant that she... believes that we're spending far too much of the taxpayer dollars preparing for something that may not happen.
I mean, you lived through a major earthquake in Vancouver?
She did specifically ask that. She thinks that we're modeling a lot of our preparation around cities that get lots of earthquakes, and we don't. And so we don't need to spend the amount of money that those cities do on their earthquakes.
See, we don't get lots of earthquakes. We're just expecting one big one.
Yeah, it's like
a duck-sized horse-sized duck problem.
We've broken Matthew.
It's a Reddit joke, Matthew.
No, it's not that. I'm so... Oh, my...
No one knew what to do with this. Literally no one knew what to do with it. And it was stunning. And so...
Okay, so in the, like, 11 or 1200s in England. You could call up levies. This is how far I have been driven by you, Councillor Hardwick. 1,000 years of history is how I have to dredge up.
Jesus Christ. This is amazing.
The levies would be called up, and they'd be called up for a specific amount of time. And usually it was about 30 days. And if the enemy had not arrived, the people who had been making up the levies, assuming that because the danger had not yet arrived, it had passed, decided that they could all go home. And that is like exactly the kind of thinking that Councillor Hardwick is putting forward here. One that we should have left in the era of Alfred the Great.
Citizen yeomanry, right?
Yeah, this is bananas, except like actually citizen yeomanry required people to actually contribute to their society as opposed to just fiddle. Well, see, another 2,000 years back I've gone.
Well, it was noted by staff as well.
Nero was playing a liar.
That a lot of earthquake preparation can be cross-applied to other natural disasters as well. But yeah, so that happened. And actually, like to carry that on a bit, I do think that councillors are getting quite a bit frustrated with Councillor Hardwick at this point during the SNC-Lavalin debate that again happened at City Hall.
No shit. In fact, Councillor Hardwick appears to be like getting quite frustrated when she like posted a bunch of things on her Facebook that were like, these councillors, these young councillors, yes, who don't understand our city. I'm like, well, number one, they were elected by your city just as you were, and you should take that into account, you effete, arrogant, horrible, horrible representative.
Well, and I'm still really not sure what that comment was about. This is a Facebook comment that she made on her not really private Facebook, that Justin McElroy...
4,600 friends.
And Justin McElroy was added by Colleen Hardwick at a point in time where they had never met each other. And so clearly this was an attempt at promotion. And so he screen grabbed this comment, which is something along the lines of, you know, people making decisions are too young to understand what they're doing, and they've rewritten the history of Vancouver, and only people that, and some of them weren't even born here. Like, stuff like that was in there, and it was bizarre.
Most of Vancouver wasn't born here, counselor.
Well, yeah, and that really does play into her sort of, like, I don't want to use the term nativist, because obviously that has a real connotation.
Dunbar diaspora.
But it really is like, somebody said to me, I can't remember who it was, and I wish I could give them credit for this one. They said, well, if you don't have a street named after one of your ancestors, you probably shouldn't be talking in Vancouver, is kind of the attitude she has. And, you know, she does have a street named after her dad.
It's a new street, though.
It's a very small
one. I'm not going to say to play devil's advocate, but to a certain extent, 8% of the city voted for Wei Young for mayor, and that's enough to get some councillors elected. Not on the Coalition Vancouver banner, but there is a constituency for nativist views in the city. Should they have a voice?
Oddly enough, those nativist views are primarily made up of a large amount of, yeah, it of did, the immigrant communities.
It did seem very much like other councillors are very frustrated with her at this point. You saw at other points in the debate that there were some what I would call jabs at her, especially during the SNC-Lavalin debate. She's got that motion still going on reviewing the city's relationship with SNC-Lavalin. Daryl Delacruz...
Because Bombardier is this bastion of like common sense and paragon.
Well,
just
to finish off about Daryl Delacruz, who was really one of the forces behind the SkyTrain for Surrey, came to speak in favor of linear induction motors and the SkyTrain technology that we use. He's quite knowledgeable about it, and he basically mopped the floor with her, which is funny because he's like a 21-year-old kid. And she kept asking, and she even asked him, like, are you being paid by any outside organizations? And he said, no, I'm not, but I did run an official campaign during the last election where all of my proceeds were publicly disclosed, and you can see them if you'd like, and so on and so forth. And other counselors would ask him questions that I think were real jabs. Like, they would say, so you said that there's a lot of misinformation about this. Is there anything specific that was said that you'd like to clear up? And he would say, well, yes, you know, this was said by some counselors, and this is why it's not true. Kennedy Stewart, Mayor Stewart, said, you clearly work really hard, and good on you for your political advocacy. Keep up the good fight. Which, given that he's directly attacking Councillor Hardwick's position, maybe he's got a point.
Well, she seems like a pretty malicious force in City Council at the moment. But that's just my center-right wing perspective. Anyway, I need to cheer myself up a little bit, so let's talk about some Vancouverada. And now we have a twofer for you, a gold, silver, and bronze Vancouverada, one that also relates perplexingly to both mines and lawyers. So, number one, a company on the Vancouver TSX has published some assaying results. They're a mining company. They're called Benchmark Metals Incorporated, and their stock jumped after the company released additional assay results from the Lawyers Gold and Silver Project. The investor reaction to these results pushed Benchmark shares up over 10% to a market capitalization of $8 million, which is quite substantial. Also, I would like to share with you from mining.com the most hilarious headline, because it just seems like a bunch of word salad. Vancouver Gold Jr. bounces on Golden Triangle drill results. And I'm sure that, yes, I could have probably parsed that slightly better, but maybe I've been having a little too much fun in Dude Chilling Park, which is our bronze.
Vancouver.
C-.
So, Dude Chilling Park, originally and still legally known as Guelph Park.
Which, by the way, I looked it up. Guelph Park is named after the Queen. Can't remember if it's Victoria, Elizabeth, or Elizabeth II, but it's named after one of the regional names in which the Queen is known by.
Regnal?
Sure.
Not regital names?
Yeah, probably that sounds more reasonable.
But the name Dude Chilling Park comes from a sculpture in the park, which is not actually in the park anymore.
It has been removed for restoration and protection because it is made of wood.
So the sculpture is by artist Michael Dennis. It depicts a reclining figure, but if you're not too artistic or creative in your imagination, looks like a bunch of twigs twined together. But
yeah,
it needs restoration.
I have super strong pareidolia, so like I see faces everywhere. Pareidolia, the...
Seeing of faces in random things.
Is this a normal word?
Yes.
Okay, that's new to me.
Like Jesus on toast.
Yeah.
That one just makes sense.
So... the sculpture is in need of restoration. There is now a campaign to save the dude of Dude Chilling Park to bronze it.
There's an Indiegogo campaign, and I went to a fundraiser for this last summer, I want to say, at R&B Brewing that was being held and organized by Councillor Weeb, of all people, then Private Citizen Weeb.
No, then Commissioner Weeb.
Oh, then Commissioner Weeb, that's right. The idea is to bring it in there. Now, Ian, you asked me, too, if the park had been renamed officially.
Yeah, because I was thinking...
And the answer is no.
The answer is, in fact, no, but kind of yes. There's like an asterisk attached. The Parks Board has allowed it to be also signed as Dude Chilling Park.
Because originally,
it's not a sign. It's an art installation.
Yeah, yes. I think we should actually point out the sign
is an art.
Is itself art. I mean,
this is the famous Dude Chilling Park. If you haven't seen the sign, why are you even listening to this podcast?
Go to Dude Chilling Park
and chill with the dude.
Yeah.
Once you've saved the dude.
And of course, cue up Politicoast, Spirits of the Law, and all the other podcasts that are part of our wonderful family. And of course, go support the Indiegogo campaign that Patrick has information on.
We'll have the link in the show notes.
In the show notes.
Yes.
Not with a bang, but with a whimper. This has been the Cambie Report.
You know, it gets really warm in here, and I feel like that's probably our problem. Our new podcasting streaming area, by the way, is very warm after about half an hour. We've been in here an hour, so
these silent booths are deadly.
I feel like we should like have a cutoff point in the agenda to actually just open the door and then like wait 5 minutes and then close it again.
Why do people? This has been the Thursday, April 25th edition of the Cambie Report. I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
And I'm Patrick Meehan.
Good ish night, folks.
Let's get that door open.